Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. This is a special Election Day edition of Realignment Cues. If you're new here, every week, every episode, we take questions here on The Realignment. We can answer your questions if you go and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Really helps people find the show. While you're inclined, while you're there, if you leave us a written review, you can ask us a question there. If you don't feel comfortable asking your question there, no worries. Take a screenshot of your 5-star review. Send it into realignmentpod@gmail.com. And every once in a while, Marshall and I do a full Realignment Cues episode, largely because we get so many questions from you guys. And you know what? We were thinking, hey, let's do it on today, Election Day. We'll help guide your thinking as you go about your day. Might be stressful, might be happy, might be sad for so many of you. And we thought, let's put a little bit more realignment into their lives.
Definitely. So, quick note for everyone, we have an amazing episode of Julius Krein of American Affairs coming out on Thursday, so we will see you then for our regularly scheduled programming. But on to the questions. This one is from Zach PPP. I've been listening to this show for a while, and especially Sagar has gone on and on about this stimulus package being a major component of the election. I think he's way off on this. This election is clear and simple. Do people in swing states want more lockdowns or do they want to reopen? I live in Michigan, and I'd be shocked if Biden wins here. The people here face one of the most strict lockdowns in the country, and the people in my area are enthusiastically voting Trump. Whole neighborhoods of signs and flags only for Trump. People do not want free money from the government. People want to go back to work and back to normal in their lives, and the choice for who will do that is clear. Sagar, that was very directly aimed at you. What is your response?
I can feel the heat, Zach. He still gave us 5-star reviews, so it's all good. We're friends, my friend. Okay, look, Zach. I would be inclined to believe you. Intuitively, it would make sense. Probably to somebody like you, I'm going to guess that you're within our average demographic, which is below the age of 45 or so, and you live in an area where other people feel so inclined. But you've always got to remember to try and take yourself out of that situation and think about people within the aggregates. And the truth is, there is not one scrap of public polling to back up what you're saying, which is that 3/4 of American voters, by and large, have specifically answered that they are not only fine with social distancing protocols, which you could translate into lockdown, not that lockdown is like a clear enough term whatsoever, and that they are willing to sacrifice economic gains in order to do so. Here's another thing that tells me why I think you're wrong, which is that the majority of the American public, the majority, not a plurality, majority, in the latest New York Times Siena poll, found that people believe that the worst is yet to come with the pandemic, as in they are not in the economic mindset that you are, my friend. They are much more in a mindset where they're afraid of the virus. Now, whether you think that that is a good or a bad thing, that doesn't really matter. What matters is how do people feel about this virus? There is no indication, again, zero indication, reams of public polling, reams of national study in the brief little election things that we've been able to see that tells me that what you're saying is correct. But hey, today's Election Day, the day that you're listening to this. And if you're right, I will eat my shit right here on the air.
Wow, that is a pretty aggressive offer if you're wrong on that one. But no, so what's fascinating about this one is something Sagar and I talk about is this idea that a huge problem we have is that all political problems, no matter how local, get nationalized. I think this is a rare case where that isn't actually happening, where people are able to sort of separate their distaste they could have with any sort of specific lockdown from the actual election choice they're going to make at the ballot box. So you could be someone in Georgia who's ticked off about churches getting closed, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to punish Joe Biden with that vote. And the other broad point that Zach should be thinking about is if you're looking at the states where we had this debate, basically back in April, May, June, July, Texas, Florida, the reopenings didn't exactly lead to just this domineering Republican resurgence. Mm-hmm. It just seems pretty clear to us as we look at it that people are very concerned about the pandemic. And when Republicans talk about getting back to work, it could be good faith, but it actually reads to a lot of people like you're saying the virus doesn't matter. You shouldn't be scared and no one's going to help you actually deal with those things because this actually is something you should be worried about.
let me back you up there, Marshall, which is that back in April and May, the three governors who were most vociferous about reopening were Brian Kemp of Georgia, Greg Abbott of Texas, and Ron DeSantis of Florida. Now, their latest approval ratings that we have show all three of those governors with the lowest approval ratings in the country. On the contrary, some of the highest approval ratings in the country are also Republican governors. But those are the Republican governors in Vermont, in Massachusetts, and Ohio. Ohio, Vermont, and Massachusetts. Also Maryland, Larry Hogan. The reason why is because they took a very different posture whenever it came to coronavirus. I wouldn't say that they were pro-lockdown. It just appeared to the average citizen that they didn't care more about the economy than they cared about average people's lives. That's especially matters when you're talking about senior citizens. That's a group that I hear they vote. I hear that they come out and they like to turn out. So all of those data points are things that I can point you to. Once again, look, could be the greatest polling error in modern American history. Totally reasonable. And if Trump does win Michigan, then you'd be right. I think that that would be the way that we could look at that lens. But there's just zero indication that that's the case right now.
Let's keep building on the data point. OpenTable, the service that people use to look at reservations for restaurants. If you look at places in the country where there is reopening, the OpenTable data clearly demonstrates, so this isn't a poll, this is hard data of what's happening in real life, that people are not returning to restaurants or other venues at the same rate that they're that they were going to beforehand. So what that suggests is that even in situations where there's a reopening, it's actually just not true that people are desperate to get back into commerce, get back into the actual workplace. And if people aren't going to restaurants or theaters the same way they were before, that means the people who are actually employed in those theaters and restaurants actually have a huge problem. It means the people that ran those restaurants and movie theaters have a huge problem. And that problem isn't their fault. This isn't sort of like the debate during too big to fail during the financial crisis where Wall Street firms made really bad decisions and then screwed the rest of us and asked for money. These are people who were running businesses, were prepared for a normal situation, but just weren't ready for a 10, 12 month, even years long slowdown of the economy. So that's why I want to object to Zach's sort of framing of this as people begging for free money, when that just isn't what this is. This isn't people sort of looking for freebies when they're just being lazy. They're being confronted by this incredibly difficult situation. And when you present people that viewpoint and don't seem empathetic, that's what leads to the really bad polling on the issue.
Yeah, let me just, I've realized I didn't even answer the part about the stimulus. And actually, that's once again, is this isn't about free money. The United States government and state governments force these people to go out of business and force many Americans to stay home, which means that they're owed remuneration. It's not about free money. They earned it by doing their public duty, by staying at home for several months, and they are owed restitution and to be made whole. I don't think a single business should go out of business because of coronavirus. I think that that's absolutely unconscionable. It's a once-in-a-lifetime event, and it's something that they don't deserve to be punished for. So in essence, I would just turn many of the facets of your question around on you. And I think this is really important because I think this is actually going to be a huge feeling on the right about how lockdowns and so much more translating into politics. But it's really, really important to think about it in the broader context of the story. Don't mean to beat up on you there, though, Zach. You're a good listener, and we still appreciate you.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll add on this is that none of what we're saying means that President Trump can't win re-election tonight. But yeah, I think what Sagar and I are arguing is that if he wins re-election, it's going to be because of the broader socio-cultural fights that we've been having for the past 4 or 5 years. It's going to be because people bought his argument that Joe Biden is sort of this decrepit remnant of the establishment. It's going to be because people thought that the left has gone too far. So on and so on and so forth. It will not be because a vast swath of Americans across the political spectrum revolted against lockdown orders. On to our next question, Sagar.
Okay, next question is from Grant. He has two questions, actually. How can the average realignment listener help the more populist elements of the GOP triumph over the libertarian elements in the GOP civil war that comes after Trump leaves office? Second, have y'all considered publishing a reading list? It could be good. As to your second question, the answer is yes. You're not the first person to ask. I definitely think that we should get on that. Marshall, what's that thing you were telling me about? Bookshop? We can do that? We'll set that up. We'll do something.
Yeah. So there's this great service called bookshop.org. It's basically an Amazon.com alternative that basically supports local bookstores. And what we can do is we could put together something called a realignment. Well, we're calling it this. It's a realignment book list, and it'll be the different books of guests that we've interviewed on the show. It could be books that we thought about as we were prepping for shows. And what's cool about this service is not only will you support local independent booksellers, you will also help support the podcast. It is actually decently expensive to put out 2 to 3 episodes a week, so we'd really support that once we come out. But to the actual other first question, how can the average realignment listener who's on the populist right affect the way things go in the GOP civil war? The first thing they can do, and this, by the way, from my level, and Sagar will definitely cut in on this too, it's been so helpful to see this exact debate play out on the Democratic side ever since 2016, sort of the post Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden debates. And if you're on the populist right, you should really learn from how those debates actually went down, because what I think happened is that the Bernie side of the aisle just made mistake after mistake after mistake when it came to sort of trying to readjust their party in a more populist direction. So for example, if you're actually looking at why Bernie lost, it's not because of the DNC, it's not because of superdelegates, it's going to be because Bernie Sanders did not get older black voters to vote for him. It's pretty straightforward. He didn't make the case in suburban counties of the U.S. for why they should support democratic socialism. You can dislike older black voters. You could say that older black voters are out of touch and are more comfortable with the status quo. You could say that suburbanites are these sort of rich people who don't really get it, but that's what your party is. So to the point of what the populist right needs to learn, if President Trump loses re-election tonight, it's going to be because he did not find a way to not only improve his margins with upper middle class voters, but he actually made upper middle class voters hate him so much that states like Georgia and Texas and Arizona are in play. And, you know, two of those three may actually go for Joe Biden. So it's really sort of thinking critically about the fact that even though you don't like suburban Wall Street Journal, country club Republicans, they're a huge part of your party. They're not able to nominate Jeb. They're not able to win the 2015-2016 primary, but they still matter. So thinking about that deeply is really critical. What do you think, Sagar?
Yeah, I mean, I just disagree, because I think that those suburban people are gone. I think that they are Democrats now, and they will be by a 2-to-1 margin. I think the mistake that the Bernie people made here, look, there was, let's go back, actually. This is their theory of the case. Their theory of the case, they acknowledged what you said. They were like, yeah, the Democratic Party is older black voters, suburban voters, and young people. So we have young people. So what we need to do is excite and overwhelm by using our coalition of young people and then bring out millions of working class voters who usually don't vote in a Democratic primary process and in the general election. That's how we'll win. So they acknowledge the current framework of the party. They just have a different theory of how to win. Now, obviously, that just didn't work. Look, Bernie himself said that. Many of these others, they were like, look, at the end of the day, our message, even though it resonated with our traditional coalitions, it was not able to excite. The second thing I would say on the Republican side, so if you're an average listener, you also have to think deeply about coalitions. Look, I mean, no matter what happens today, whether Trump wins or loses, he will have lost massive, massive margins of college-educated whites. I think that that's definitive, and I think it's likely for all time. I think those people are quote-unquote Biden Republicans now, as in they will now be voting for the Democratic Party in the same way that demographic voted for Ronald Reagan, which means that if you're the GOP, you have this coalition currently of working-class whites, which you're winning by 2-to-1 margin. You have Hispanics, which you're now winning by about a 1-to-2 margin. And now you have this large deficit, which used to be made up of these college-educated whites. Now you have a lot of different options. You could try to win back those people. I don't think that that's going to happen. Because even if you did, you could win back maybe 10%, but you've just lost 25%. That's just not enough to win a national popular vote election or even an electoral college victory. Or you could look to making up ground amongst Hispanic and black voters who are in a more working-class demographic. You can actually see this in a state like Texas, where I think that Trump is going to win, not even though there's a huge college-educated white swing. The reason why is because Biden's doing worse than Hillary did with Hispanic voters. But the profile of these Hispanic voters is uniquely Trumpist, and they're not old-style Republicans. As in, these are people who are like pro-life, pro-gun, pro-Medicare for all, and pro-fight for 15. That's just really, and maybe part of a union. These are like not people who track onto the American political system as we know it right now. So I think that if the Republican Party is going to win, it's got to be on the backs of people like that who are, I wouldn't call them even culturally right wing. I would call them even more as like cultural libertarians who just want to be left alone and who don't like some of the more social justice elements of the party. But on economic issues would be much more identified with what we currently identify as the American left. So I think that that's basically the only way forward.
Yeah, I just don't see it, because I think what you're doing here is you're writing off a segment of the party that's inconvenient for your political viewpoint, right? So if you look at your priorities, they're not deficit hawkery. They're not upper income tax cuts. So by you saying, oh yeah, we're just never going to win suburban voters again, that could be possible, but I'm just concerned that you're doing too much wishful thinking, because you would actually like to have a Republican Party that didn't have to cater to those voters. But the reality here is, if you actually look at those voters, I don't think a lot of those voters in long term are super pumped to vote for Kamala Harris. I think they largely think Joe Biden, maybe if they're right, maybe they're wrong, is this harmless person. And they just sort of hate Trump. So it's, I think it would be a mistake to overemphasize how long term swings from Trump would be. The other point that I would add here too is that even look at that story of the Reagan Democrats. Yeah, you know, Ronald Reagan in 1980, 1984 peeled off a lot of people from the traditional Democratic coalition. But 12 years later, a combination of Bill Clinton and Ross Perot did the same thing as well too. Bill Clinton was winning states like West Virginia, Tennessee, etc. So I just don't think it's possible, especially given how fractious the realignment era is, for us to make any definitive statements about what coalitions look like long term. I think it's pretty clear that Trump, for good and for ill, is so singularly unique that that's just going to simply have to be something that we can't extrapolate to other politicians.
I missed something, actually, when I talked about this. It's important because you brought it up, which is the way things are tracking. It's not just about things that are frozen in time. It's about the way that things are tracking. And if you overlay things here, we're talking about suburbanites. Honestly, even suburbanite really isn't the correct way to identify it. If you put and superimpose one factor that matters more than anything else, it's education. Which is that in zip codes with a supermajority of people who have college education, they are overwhelmingly donating and supporting to Joe Biden. And in zip codes with a supermajority of people without college degrees, it's the exact same thing with Trump. So when you track that on, and you can currently look at the university educated class in America, just as where they are and then where things are trending among that group, this is why I'm saying I'm writing it off into the future, which is that if you have this unique episode right now, you have a decent amount of those people are going to stay within the Democratic Party. Then you also take how things are trending in general amongst college educated voters, not just who are graduating today, the ones who are entering their 28, you know, early, late 20s, early 30s, etc., much more likely to be much more culturally liberal as well as having fiscal conservatism. The Democratic Party, as long as they just adhere to their cultural liberalism and give them some deficit hawkery, why wouldn't those people vote for the Democrats? And they probably should. And that, again, I'm just saying that the way that those things are trending, yeah, look, I mean, an average Republican like Romney might today win like 40% of that coalition. But again, this is not even enough to win a national popular vote election. To win a national popular vote election or electoral college, you'd have to win them by a 52 to 56% margin. And I just don't ever see that happening for a Republican presidential election again for a very long time.
Yes, yeah, so let me reframe the question in a little more precise way based on what you just said. Here's the question. You and I agree that the long-term trend for the GOP is along the education working class point. What I think we're maybe disagreeing on is the importance of minimizing how disastrously bad you do with the suburbs, because long term and with college educated persons. And I don't think that, I think you moderated your position a bit, but I'm just saying that saying outright, oh yeah, we've lost the college educated, that's a disaster, because that's going to lead you to make a variety.
Wait. Yeah. But think about this. Think about when Democrats say they've lost white working class voters, what are they saying? They're saying that we lose them by a 2-to-1 margin. That's basically where we are right now. So when I say loss, I'm not saying you're going to lose. It's not like the black vote. You're not going to win like 5%, 2% or whatever. I'm saying, yeah, you're going to win about a third of that vote. It's not going to be a majority coalition.
But that's what I say when I mean that. But this is the thing, though. I'm not just speaking or debating with you. There's some people who are going to go nameless, who, to quote a friend of ours, sort of lean too far into the realignment. And because here's the key thing about your framework when you're talking about how we're losing 2-to-1 of college educated people. implicit, though, is still the need to get that 33% out. So this thing that I'm saying is very important for anyone who's a populist right person. You have to figure out a way to also increase the GOP's chances with sort of like the college, like non-college educated vote, while also not pissing off every single soccer mom and her cousin in Georgia, Florida, and Texas. Because that's, once again, if Trump loses tonight, the thing that he could not simply do. So it's the question is, how can you have a populist Republican Party, or how can you even have a more sort of working class oriented Republican Party that doesn't do that while pissing off too many people? Because that's the clear thing that isn't being done tonight.
Totally. All right, what's next?
So this is from Wiggles the Worm 69. I think you win creativity points for that one, Wiggles. Love the show, and the variety of guests is fantastic. My question, can you guys define neoliberalism and explain why you aren't neolibs? Because I feel like you are on everything other than trade policy, immigration, and a very vague commitment to industrial policy, which might just come down to trade policy and some tax credits. Sagar's answer about healthcare on a recent episode seemed to highlight this to me. He described almost to a T a typical center-left neoliberal view of healthcare policy. Keep private insurance, use market mechanisms with some corporatism, such as subsidies and tax credits, along with safety net programs on the margins. So his question, Sagar, is, are you, define, and then answer whether or not you are a secret neoliberal?
I think that's a hilarious question. You're getting something there. I feel subtweeted, but you're getting to something there, which is, look, I think the actual answer is that the critique of neoliberalism matters from the right and the left. From the left, it's definitely going to be on a more, it's going to, on the left, it's going to be something like healthcare, right? But here would be my counter, which is that if you're on the left and you're for Medicare for all and you're for essentially an open border, then you have a neoliberal immigration policy. So really what I would tell you is that there are both elements of the populist right and left which retain some parts of neoliberalism, because wouldn't you be a fool to reject some policies on which you do agree with? I'm not just saying that all neoliberal policy is bad. And if we were to define it, it would be policy and a worldview which prioritizes a few key things. Number one is the idea of openness, both with markets and with immigration. And number two would be the reliance on technocracy. Now, implicit in all of that is that if you are against that, then you're supposedly some sort of reactionary person. Look, I am against elements of that. I think you can lean too far into technocracy. I think you can lean too far into the so-called relying on expertise. And I think that openness in and of itself isn't something that you should maximize when there are other negative externalities that are approached with that. So whenever you ask about whether we're secretly neoliberals or not, I don't even necessarily think that that's the correct answer, because to me, whenever I'm decrying neoliberalism, what I'm really talking about are the excesses of the 75-year world order that we've kind of created as the United States. And I'm saying I want to take us back to a more nationalist position, which rejects some neoliberal overreach policies that we have had over the last 30 years in particular.
What's so funny about this is, and I really like the question, by the way, because it shows the listeners listening, but also they're sort of able to get into the definitions. It's super important to understand that populism is not a policy platform. Yes. It's a style of politics. So there's actually a world where you could have neoliberal populists who are just super aggressive about how elites are not market friendly enough. And Sagar and I talked about this once, but you could actually have a world where in Great Britain, let's say there's some people who hate the National Health Service, hate government healthcare. You could have a populist neoliberal critique of that moment.
Just wait. That's a thing in Latin America, dude. That literally is how many Latin American dictators, in the 1970s and 1980s, rose to power by running against the social safety net of the state and arguing for opening up markets and for free market capitalism. That literally is exactly what happened.
Yeah, so that's the key thing. There actually isn't that much of a contradiction. So in terms of the way we're defining neoliberalism, so it's not the parody super online version, but basically the idea that in the 1970s, the New Deal had gone too far and we didn't need to have all these government agencies determining everything. I don't think it was okay that the government was setting prices for airlines. I don't think it was great that the government set prices for interstate trucking. That was excess. So yeah, I'm relatively in favor of broad deregulation in those sort of industries. That's different than financial industries. I largely think that trade, when negotiated properly, is a good thing. I genuinely, and neither Sagar nor I, like the, what were they, 70% tax rate during that period. Neoliberals, especially at the start, did a lot of good things. But if you see this problem, and you see it with every part of American politics, Sagar and I dunk on Reaganism, but back in the 80s, there's a lot of good stuff there.
Yeah, probably needed it.
It has gone too far. So if we want to get to the core of it, would Sagar and I be comfortable chatting with a neoliberal in the 70s and 80s? Yeah, complete would be. A lot of really good critiques. What we're not comfortable with and what we're very aggressive on, as Sagar put it, is the excess. It's the sort of unthinking, to sort of bring up an example of this. Sagar, did you watch the new West Wing episode that they put on HBO Max?
No, I didn't watch it yet.
It's actually really, really excellent television. It's basically a play, really well done. We could separate the sort of dunking on Aaron Sorkin from the fact that he's actually very good at TV. But on the episode, you have a character, Josh Lyman, who, this is an episode which came out in the year 2000. He says, "We know that opening up trade makes everyone better." And he basically implies that anyone who thinks otherwise is a fool. Look, that was neoliberal arrogance at its worst. It was sort of a confluence of Hollywood and sort of the excesses of Clintonite liberalism. So that's where we're sort of critiquing. I'm not rejecting the idea that markets aren't usually like the right way to go and that there are such things as too much government overreach. But thanks for the question. That's a really useful one. What's next, Sagar?
Yeah, that's really good. Okay, next question from Michael from Tucson. Point of reference here is episode 61, which I listened to yesterday. Most of the time, I agree with you, but I feel like I need to push back on some of the things you agreed Ms. Kostin on. Most important here is her haughty dismissal of what I called meta issues, or big picture issues like rioting in the streets, out of control wokeness in academia and the media, unchecked immigration by flyover countries. She is convinced that common people are not as concerned with these issues as they are with issues affecting their pocketbooks. More importantly, she feels Trump is a moron for sticking to those issues in his late 2020 campaign and that this will doom his reelection. I disagree. This is an important question, I think, Michael. Actually, go ahead, Marshall. You can talk first. I'll come after.
Yeah. So several things. Obviously, we can't speak for Jane, and Jane is very good at what Jane does, so I'll sort of bucket her tone separately. I would focus on the core of her idea, though, which is that it's one thing to recognize, as you're pointing out, that if you were to poll a lot of sort of people in the categories you're referring to, things like Black Lives Matter, things like the various protests and the riots in sort of late July that got really out of hand, you know, what's happening in Portland with the Antifa versus the city debates, obviously those things would pull very terribly. So we're not trying to claim that those cultural issues like don't matter. And something that Sagar and I have always pushed back against on the show is basically telling people what they should care the most about or thinking that people aren't doing it the right way. So if it came off like Sagar and I were saying, oh yeah, these rubes care about the culture wars, what idiots, that's not the claim at all. It's up to each of us in our system to determine what matters the most. And I trust that people really get it. What I am saying though, and this goes back to our earlier response on the issue about the lockdowns, is if you actually look at what people are expressing, they care much more about the fact that our economy is in the crater after a years-long and future-looking COVID fight. And if you look at what the Trump campaign, I think, has screwed up so much in the past few months, it's assuming that those culture war battles are enough to make up for how badly the country is perceiving the performance on the economy and with the response to COVID itself. That just is not there. It's not in any sort of polling, and it doesn't indicate that that's actually what's true here. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing, Michael. I mean, if you listen to me, I care a lot about meta issues that you talked about. Out of control wokeness in academia, in media, rioting, unchecked immigration, 1619 Project. I mean, you hear it from me all the time. But here's the thing, man, which is that you have to understand the priorities within people's lives that are not just you. So I agree that those are pernicious attacks upon people like us. I also think that those are pernicious things that would destroy the lives of many average Americans if they are put into government policy and practice. But you have to meet people where they are. And when many people, 30 million people, are on unemployment, when so many people are facing economic distress, that's what they want to hear first. And all these meta issues are kind of fill in the blank stuff. This is about how people vote. And we, over and over again, we know that these more cultural factors in times of economic distress are much more overlooked. I would point you to Obama's campaign in 2008. I would point you to Trump's campaign in 2016. Many of the people who voted for Trump, one third of the people who voted for the man were pro-choice. One third for one of the most pro-life presidents to ever hold the Oval Office. Do you know why? Because they thought he was going to materially improve the conditions of their lives, particularly across the industrial Midwest, and they didn't particularly care enough about their social policy position in order not to vote against him. I think that's a perfect example, right, about what we might call a meta or social issue there that could be really, really important to some people, but which ended up not being within a ranked priority of choice for voters whenever it came to Trump in 2016. And I think that is where the great American middle lies. If you're on the right, you're already incensed about the 1619 Project or any of the other meta issues that you're talked about. But that's not how you win. You don't just win by doing that. You have to meet people where they are. I think Biden has done a better job relative to Trump, not saying he's done a good job, of meeting people where they are and how they feel about this pandemic and how they feel about this economy. And I think that's the important thing to keep in mind.
Well said. On to our next question. Zach writes, Sagar, you've been yeah, not making people happy the last few weeks.
Good.
Sagar constantly hyping Joe W. got me to listen. His answer to the debt, he's referring to the Joe Weisenthal episode a few weeks back. His answer, he means Joe's answer to the debt, was as underwhelming as could be. The debt doesn't matter because he's been alive 40 years and he hasn't had to pay any of it back. Like what? That's spelled W-U-T. Or his theoretical response to being, or his theoretical response being that he can't be in debt to yourself. What? Neither of those makes any sense or is sufficient to help determine monetary policy. If monetary policy can be summed up by, well, I've never been billed for the debt, then shouldn't we just go ham? Why not universal healthcare plus UBI plus student debt payoff plus huge military plus new houses for everyone? The fact that you allowed that conversation to continue without drilling down on how much is too much is absolutely crazy to me. Why not $5 trillion in stimulus, guys? Anyone want to answer that? Why not Lambos for everyone? Like, why am I taxed, period? Why not pay teachers $150K a year? Surely a big investment into teaching would help everyone. We can't be in debt to ourselves, right? Seriously, answer it.
Wow, I feel personally attacked, Zach. Look,
quick thing, Zach typed this out on Apple Podcasts, so we must have actually listened
really
to this episode and been very angry about what he heard.
Zach, listen, I hear you. It's a common refrain. Also, I want to know where all these libertarians listen to the podcast. But hey, we love each and every one of you. Listen, here's the important thing to understand. We're not saying that debt never matters. We're saying that in times of immense crisis, like right now, that debt is not our chief concern. I actually just spoke to Senator Josh Hawley today on my show over at Rising, and I asked him about this very same thing, which is how should Republicans care about the deficit? And here's what his answer, which is that if you care about paying back debt and deficits, then ultimately you have to be a strong nation that's capable of doing that. You have to have enough productive capacity as a workforce, as a people, as a culture, in order to make any good on your debt in the future whatsoever. So what I would tell you is $5 trillion in stimulus and Lambos for everyone and all of that, teachers. Yeah, that's probably too much. But there are elements of stimulus in a time of massive economic depression, in a time when you have hundreds of thousands of small businesses going closed, you could say, hey, if we do not spend X amount of money now, then we are going to lose $6 to $7 trillion in productive capacity over the next 1 or 2 years, by the way, which totally could happen. So I would tell you that if you are concerned about the debt, not injecting stimulus into the economy at a minimal degree, like $1 to $2 trillion right now, would make it so that you'd have to spend and borrow and ultimately lose out on your ability to pay your debt in the future. That's also what Joe is getting at, which is that the whole grandkids thing presumes that your grandkids who are alive right now also need some food to eat. And if they don't have food to eat, then they're going to have subpar development. And if they have subpar development, then they're not going to be productive members of our society. And if they're not productive members of our society, then we won't be able to pay any of the debt back. So I think that that is kind of a circular way of answering your question. Also recommend you go and you listen to Chris Arnotti when we talk about his soft MMT stance, which is kind of very close to where I am right now. MMT being something called modern monetary theory, which is kind of the extreme version of what you're talking about, which says that debt doesn't matter at all. I've never claimed that. I just don't think it is the chief concern of our political problems at this moment.
Yeah, the key thing here, and I appreciate Zach calling out our need to push back on people, because I hate when podcast hosts let people sort of bloviate. But the key thing is, Joe was not actually claiming that we need a huge military, new houses, universal healthcare, UBI. All he was saying was, in the context of the conversation, hey, if we're looking at the debate over whether or not we pass a stimulus package to support a cratering economy, or we debate about the debt and deficit in very hypothetical theoretical terms, we should obviously choose the stimulus. That's our position. If he was to come in and do a sort of parody Green New Deal plus massive houses in UBI, we definitely would have pushed back. But I think it's really key that we not debate in these sort of hypotheticals that don't actually exist. The debate in our country is not, do we pay teachers $150K a year? The debate is, do we give schools resources so that they can reopen as we believe they both should be properly? That's the actual debate. So once again, I just don't think there's anyone who's seriously making that claim, and we should engage what people are actually saying instead of doing the hypotheticals. And broadly speaking, to the actual politics of this, when was the last time we actually paid down the debt, had balanced budgets? It was during the 1990s when, you know, actually that whole end of history post-Cold War period was going pretty well for people. That was a period where the biggest problem in American politics was sort of Bill Clinton's philandering, right? If we could go back to that, that sounds like a really amazing sort of time. But that was the key thing. And this goes to Sagar's point about a strong nation. Cutting the debt, dealing with the deficit is one of the most sort of fractious things we could do in our politics because of how zero sum this is. If you're cutting money for the military, that means military bases that employ people are closing. If you're cutting food stamps or social programs, that's going to affect people's livelihoods. There are actual real trade-offs, and you try to make those trade-offs in a way that people don't trust, it's not going to go anywhere. So the way that people who actually want to cut the debt and deficit, if they actually want people to favor their politics, the time to start a fight is not during a literal economic recession where people are out of their livelihoods. This is the worst time to do it. What we should do, and this goes to Joe's point and to Sagar's point, is actually get the country back on a good footing again and then have a serious debate about the debt and the deficit. Something Sagar and I were very unhappy with from a political and policy perspective was President Trump's decision to pursue aggressive tax cuts after his election. That would have been a great time to have a debate about what we were spending money on, how we were sort of doing it. So that's the key sort of thing. If Republicans want to make their position on the debt, that they'll just totally go along with massive tax cuts, regardless of whether or not those policies are good. But then the second there's a debate about offering people remuneration for the economy closing, they're then going to freak out. That's the exact way to make it so that no one takes the debt seriously.
Yeah, I think that's right. Okay, let's see here. What is next? It's from Blavidhoff. Is there any issue where the populist wings of the parties can unite to effectively apply pressure on the government and media spheres from both sides? Or are the party structures too rigid to allow this? I thought COVID stimulus would have been it, but clearly that didn't work out. We get this question a lot, and I think it really depends, Marshall, on the area. I think one area that I did see something like this work is like when Mike Lee and Bernie Sanders teamed up on Yemen policy, or when Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin and Josh Hawley of Missouri teamed up on looser monetary policy. There are going to be issues where the two unite. But on the big national issues, I just think it's never going to happen because of the way that partisan politics works. All politics are national, and that is just one of these things where if you fall on a different side of that, I just don't see anybody breaking. I mean, look, even Bernie Sanders himself just told Crystal, my co-host on Rising, that he wasn't going to push for a stimulus before the election. So there you go.
Go back to our conversation about neoliberalism. Populism is a tactic. It's not a political philosophy. The biggest mistake we see people making when they think about this issue, when they bring it to us in their questions, is they imply that there's some sort of political and policy synthesis between the right on the populist side and the left on the populist side. No, there largely isn't. At best, you have a critique of big tech and corporate power, but not really when you go into it deeply. So for example, on the big tech issue, the populist right thinks that social media companies and tech companies themselves use their power to suppress conservative speech. Oftentimes, people on the populist left are far more concerned with consumers and small businesses when they frame their things. So they're just totally different. So because there's no actual synthesis here, and the only thing that's shared is a style of politics, a style of rhetoric, an argument that different elites and different industries have too much power, that isn't actually a coherent framework by which you could do something. The closest issue at best, Sagar, would probably be Afghanistan in terms of a big national issue. I would bet that the Afghanistan issue and Middle Eastern interventions would be that issue. But then, funnily enough, the second you got into that, that wouldn't extend to, for example, China, because much of those populist right Republicans would argue that U.S. power is misused, but they wouldn't support cutting the military or cutting the Pentagon the way that people on the populist left would. So this is really does not get you anywhere.
I completely agree. These things just fall apart way too quickly. What's next?
So this is from Ben from New Jersey, our last long question for the day. And seriously, we really appreciate the long questions because it's good to hear people thinking about this. My question is about the Republican Party's refusal to acknowledge the real danger that climate change is to the U.S. and to the world. After watching the VP debate, I was not surprised, but so disappointed in both parties' responses to climate change, especially Mike Pence's. I understand why they said what they said about fracking, aka Pennsylvania, and the Green New Deal, but when thinking about the big picture and the longer trajectory of where the GOP is going, I don't get their ignorance. I don't understand how they don't see the political upside in joining the Democratic Party and every other government in the world in addressing the very real threat of climate change. In my eyes, I think if the Republicans changed direction on this issue, it would really help them politically. I don't think they realize how many independent and Democratic voters, especially young ones, they lose and isolate themselves from because they don't believe the scientists, the economists, or the U.S. military when they say this is the largest threat to our country today. Therefore, my question is, do you foresee in the near future the GOP making a 180-degree turn on this issue? And regardless, what are the policy concerns or ideas that you guys have on addressing climate change? Full disclosure, I'm a Gen Z college student from New Jersey studying the scientific, technical, and policy solutions on how to address climate change. So this is an issue I hold in high regard.
I think it's a great question, Ben. And actually, I would direct you back to our episode with Michael Schellenberger. He actually wrote a book and entire about this. And I think that you're right. I think that not addressing or believing climate change is incredibly stupid. I would say that the solutions I think that are put forward by much of the left are fantastical and ridiculous on their face. So let me give you a preview of what I might embrace, which is the idea of nuclear maximalism. Something that I just saw in the New York Times was about how nuclear fission and smaller nuclear reactors could be within the timescale of 3 to 5 years. That's something which could dramatically change the way that we all live our lives and actually cut down on fossil fuels. And for some reason, the nuclear energy is completely ignored in the Green New Deal by any of these so-called populist lefties for reasons that I'm still haven't really been able to understand. The second is also geopolitics, which is that, look, people, China and India alone are the vast majority of carbon emissions in this country. And if you want to do anything about it, then you would have to target both of those places. Now, a Green New Deal in America is cute and it's nice, but it doesn't do anything about China or India. You might say, yeah, but we should be in the Paris Climate Accords and we can try and constrict them. They didn't constrict them whatsoever beyond baselines that they'd already agreed to hit. And in many cases, they could cheat and they weren't binding whatsoever. So limiting the industrial production of China, either voluntarily or by some sort of economic policy, is be far more effective in cutting the world's carbon emissions than anything else. And I've never heard yet a coherent answer from the left on this. It's always some version of, well, we have to lead first before they're going to come and join you. They're not going to join you. They will frack to eternity. They will burn coal power, whatever is cheapest, as long as they can improve their industrial production. They literally do not care. And India is the same way because they need to sustain different growth models for as long as they possibly can. So I think that the future should be the creation of technology, which is actually sustainable and actually could be real in terms of changing the conditions of the way that we use power, not like wind, not like solar, and particularly not like geothermal. It would have to be actual game-changing technology, which the only one on the horizon right now is nuclear power. What do you think, Marshall?
Yeah, I'd object a bit to the aggressive framing on China, not on a facts level, because you're totally correct about the reality that most of the future emissions are going to come from rising powers like India and China. But there is a way that we could extend your nuclear maximalism and real deep fascination with using technology to address these issues to an international scale. So, you know, there's a world where Paris Climate Accord 2.0, which is going to happen if Vice President Biden wins the presidency tonight, needs to focus more on serious technological development, on serious efforts to work for other countries there. Because it doesn't seem to me that the alternative of a sort of climate trade war, which is sort of what you're winking at, is actually going to be something that anyone sort of puts on the table.
Call them climate tariffs. You call them whatever you want. I just want
climate tariffs. The climate tariffs just aren't going to happen. So just as the Green New Deal is unrealistic, I'd say climate tariffs are in the same category from a different direction. I appreciate Sagar's giggles at his trolliness, but it's a good phrasing. Someone should definitely pick that up if they're looking for policy papers that can get play on Twitter. But the broader point to the politics, which you're asking, why is it that Republicans ignore this issue when in many ways it sort of makes sense? A couple things. Number one, culture war. Something that really unfortunately happened with climate change. Sagar and I take climate change very seriously. We not just believe, because believe implies it's faith. Like, we know this is a serious issue. But for a lot of people, it's tied up in culture war battles. So the Green New Deal for many Republican voters isn't about trying to address the really serious problem of climate change. It's about far-off elites, AOC, et cetera, trying to make it so cows can't fart on their farms, which is sort of the disastrous sort of initial Green New Deal that came out of AOC's office. So it's so tied up in culture war fights that it can't be sort of thought of from the perspective of nuclear power. Because as Sagar is pointing out, if you were to actually sit down with Republican voters in many of these respects and talk about these issues in the abstract, I think they would think that was great. I think that would be a great thing. There's a way that initiatives such as the Green New Deal can be reframed in the sense of infrastructure repair, serious investment in the future of the country that would make it make more sense. But the second you try to tie it up in a culture war fight of climate change, it's going to go away. So that's, I think, a serious error that people on the left make. And then secondly, in terms of why this issue actually does matter, it does matter because of those same suburban voters that we sort of went back. If the GOP is trying to minimize its losses in the suburbs, to Sagar's point about them being probably gone in the majoritarian sense, but still important, you can't have GOP politicians running around saying, I'm not a scientist, I can't answer whether climate change is real or not. Those answers, you could critique Whole Foods suburban voters for choosing environmental issues so high on their sort of priority list, are just devastating and they're just unnecessary. It's possible to say, I believe climate change is a serious threat, but I think the Green New Deal is deeply unserious. We need to focus on technological development, the way this country's always dealt with these future-looking issues. In the 1970s and the 1960s, everyone was afraid that there was going to be massive starvation, and instead we had the Green Revolution because we used technology and agricultural development to prevent that from happening. We can do that again now. That is a standard answer that people on the right can use. People on the right could point to things like Elon Musk. They could sort of focus on science and technology. It doesn't have to be there. It's really just an example of laziness on GOP politicians' sides.
Totally agree. I also think I wanted to just emphasize that culture war point, which is that, look, you know, Marshall, remind me, what's that book on Louisiana and white working class voters?
Strangers in Their Own Land.
Yes.
By Hochschild or something.
Fantastic book. It's someone like New York City researcher who goes and spends a lot of time talking with Republican voters in the state of Louisiana who are dramatically affected by oil spills and environmental degradation and more. And they're straight up not only anti-climate change, they are anti-punishing any of the businesses which destroyed their communities. And the reasons why is because they see it, I think rightfully so, as a leftist takeover of their lives. So if you believe in a Green New Deal, or if you believe in transformative climate policy, then you should be doing everything in your power to make sure that it is not presented as some sort of takeover of somebody else's life and a destruction of their culture, because that is exactly how they see it. I really recommend that you go and you read that book. Okay.
And this is and just actually a bit on that real quick though, Sagar. Think of what happened when they unveiled the Green New Deal in Congress. It was basically stuffed full of every single Democratic Party priority ever.
Yeah. Exactly.
That is the worst thing you can do if you're trying to make it seem like this is a serious issue. You can't just include every single union carve-out you've ever sort of wanted. You can't just, and there's actually a world where a jobs guarantee would make sense within the context of the Green New Deal, but you can't have jobs guarantee XL with every single handout ever in that sort of program. This doesn't actually work from a political perspective. Okay, last two questions. We're really going through these to help you guys get as many of these out as possible. This is from Isatores95. Where do traditional conservative social convictions fit into the future of the Republican Party? I'm talking things like abortion, LGBTQIA plus rights, immigration, etc.
Well, I would disaggregate immigration from there because immigration politics is very different than the other two things that you're thinking about. I think the Republican Party is always going to be the base of religious conservatives.
That's the way things are.
Evangelicals and religious conservatives, religious Catholics and religious Jews are an important part of the Republican constituency. This is also something which is anathema to many of the social leftists, I think, who listen to this podcast or who watch Rising. And that's fine. Nobody's saying that you have to be in the same coalition. The only thing that I would say is that the old theories of how the Republican Party should work, which was called fusionism, the alliance between social conservatives, libertarian economic theory, and neoconservative foreign policy, has obviously fallen apart. And what I think this podcast and a lot of what we're talking about here is not targeting or shedding religious voters. It's how do you build onto those coalitions to create one that can win a national popular vote election and an electoral college victory in the United States. So to my answer to you is that they will remain a part of the Republican Party. The only question is, how do you create a new fusionist consensus in such that they can actually win elections? What do you think, Marshall?
So two quick things on this. Number one, if I think back to something that I was just 100% wrong on, and so was the conventional wisdom, and you hear this in blue states often, you hear people say things like, if the Republican Party were more pro-LGBTQ, if it were pro-choice, it would just do better with young people. And that's just something that just isn't true. And in many ways, Trump has disproven that. Trump isn't looking down for tonight's election because in many ways of his Supreme Court appointments, he's been incredibly socially conservative. And Tiffany Trump going around having her pro-LGBTQ rallies is not going to make a difference in either direction. This could go either way. He won because he made a very specific economic critique while keeping the social conservatives in the coalition. So the coalition's part is the most important thing that we try to get everyone to think about, which is that even if, let's say, pro-choice, let's say pro-life voters are only a third of the Republican Party, that's actually a huge portion of the base. And once again, the percentage is actually much higher than that. Let's just imagine
It's two-thirds.
But let's just say it was just even one-third of the party's base. If you don't get that party's base out reliably, you lose all of your elections. So this idea you could have a GOP that sort of rejects social conservatism, or in many ways just sort of sidelines it while still being successful, just is ridiculous. Because people who sort of think that way, in many cases, they're actually just sort of Democrats now. That describes Larry Hogan of Maryland. It describes Governor Charlie Baker of Massachusetts. The reality is that version of the Republican Party, because of the nationalized politics, doesn't exist anymore. So it's a mistake to think those things are true. But the second point, and this is the interesting trend that matters for the right, is that if we're thinking of the biggest shifts in our politics in our lifetimes, it's been that social conservatives are no longer on top. If you're looking at the big fights, aside from court appointments, the right has lost fights about gay marriage. They've lost fights about LGBTQ rights. They've lost the bathroom bill fights. Those consistent areas mean that the right can no longer act as if it's on top when it comes to making decisions with social conservatism. Think back to the 1980s, which obviously Sagar and I weren't around for. You had organizations called the Moral Majority. The idea was social conservatism is actually the norm, and the job of the right is to help impose that viewpoint. That's obviously no longer true. So something that social conservatives are going to have to do moving forward is conceive of the fact that they are no longer capable of on their own dictating terms in our politics. And when they act like they can, it ends disastrously, aka the way the gay marriage fight ended. So that's a very important thing to think of.
Yeah, ask Todd Akin how that worked out.
Well said. 2012 throwbacks to anyone who doesn't know what he's talking about. Final question. I wonder, actually, this is the perfect way to end for this episode with a Steve Bannon reference. Sorry, this is from Niche. I wonder what you guys think of Steve Bannon saying that one of the key pillars of right-wing populism is the deconstruction of the administrative state.
Yeah, I think it's funny because it's almost contradictory, right? But it's not, if you think about it, which is that when he talks about that, what he's saying is the deconstruction of the current administrative state. If I would bet if he were to ask Steve, he would tell you he's not opposed to administrative state or the use of government power in order to enact policy. He just thinks that the current version of that administrative state is not capable of doing that. And so it's actually a pretty simple answer to your question, which I actually generally agree with him, which is, look, one of the reasons that Trump's agenda didn't take off and didn't work is because they didn't have anybody who was capable of taking a job who in a high level position in the United States government who agreed with him. It's actually really that simple. And so this is actually something I can't wait to talk with Julius Krein about in our next episode, which is that the future of populism might actually be technocratic. It might literally be as simple as training lawyers to think in the way that we do about trade, or training, you know, immigration people in order to think about the way that we do about immigration, or think about tax policy in the way that we do about tax policy. It might literally be as simple as just creating a cadre of young staffers who actually agree with us. I think that kind of ties a bow into what Steve is talking about, but also what the future might look like.
To tie a bow on this, the part that's been really interesting over the past few years is watching the right struggle to accept the reality that if you're looking at the centers of power in our country, this is very much a Michael Lind idea, from entertainment to culture to the commanding heights of the economy in corporate America and Wall Street. Those are areas which, largely speaking, are permanently gone, to the earlier debate about the suburbs. The only place where the right clearly has an ability to seize power, not even seize power, because that implies you're doing something illegal, but the only place where the right can actually take power in straightforward fashion is government. So when the right becomes obsessed with sort of small government libertarianism, diminishing the power of the state, in many ways, you could believe that those are the right philosophical and political decisions to make, but you should keep in mind that when you attack the existence of the state, and this is different than Bannon's critique, but when you sort of focus on sort of, you know, Grover Norquist's idea of making government so small that you could drown it in the bathtub, what you're really doing is removing the last area of input that you actually have to take power with. So that's just a really key context, and it just goes to our point that we've always stressed this season and the season before about thinking about your coalition, thinking about power, and understanding how these things commingle in ways that don't always line up with the traditional philosophical debates we've all come to. Geez, that was a lot of questions.
Oh, I feel worn out after answering all those questions, but you guys just keep sending in so many good ones, so we have to keep doing it. Keep some of this in mind as you're watching the news today. I know it's a little bit more above the clouds, and I hope that this is helpful in the way that you think about politics. We're going into a really transformative era, no matter really which way happens, whether Trump wins or whether Biden wins. And as Eric Weinstein said on our last podcast, just be kind to one another, no matter who you are out there. Give your family a hug. And just remember that we're all Americans and that we're going to get through this, and it's all going to be okay.